The reading is from Matthew chapter 10, verses 26 to 28. So do not be afraid of people. Whatever is now covered up will be uncovered, and every secret will be made known. What I am telling you in the dark, you must repeat in broad daylight, and what you have heard in private, you must announce from the housetops. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of God, who can destroy both body and soul in hell.
Of all the newspaper headlines covering the death of Osama bin Laden, the most provocative may have been the New York Daily News. Maybe you saw this. It was publicized on all of the cable channels. Their headline on Monday morning read, "Rot in Hell," and had a full-page picture of Osama bin Laden. And so the news media, fond of polls as they are, and they will poll absolutely anything, asked Americans if they thought that Osama bin Laden was now in hell. Maybe CNN called you up and asked you your opinion. Well, according to the pollsters, 61% of the public said yes, with 1 in 10 saying no, and nearly a quarter unsure. I thought that was a fascinating poll. The thing that was really fascinating to me was, wow, only 61%? Think he's in hell? What does a person have to do these days to deserve to go to hell? I would have thought if anybody qualified, Osama would. But that got me thinking just more deeply about the subject of judgment and hell. And it's something that we do need to think about deeply. And I'm sure one reason why only 61% think that Osama bin Laden is in hell is because there are just many in our society now who do not believe in the existence of hell. This is also kind of related to the question of how gleeful we should be about Osama bin Laden being in hell. I was thinking at this when one of you, I won't give this person's name, but I'm very grateful for this person because they called me up on Sunday night to tell me the news. I'd already gone to bed and turned the television off. Wasn't asleep yet. But I was thrilled that she called and told me. And when I talked to her the next day, she said, "You know, I'm just so happy about this. Osama bin Laden is burning in hell right now. This is great. This is wonderful." And then kind of maybe thinking to herself, maybe I shouldn't be quite so happy about this, she said, "This might not be very Christian." Well, people can have all kinds of different feelings about this. I know there was a father who lost his daughter, I believe, on 9/11. And they asked him what he thought about the news of Osama bin Laden's death. And he said, "Well, you know, I guess I'm glad," but he says, "You know, it's just hard to be happy about anybody's death anymore." That's perfectly appropriate attitude too. But brothers and sisters, let me tell you, if you are happy about the death of Osama bin Laden, And if it gladdens your heart that he is in hell, you're fine. That might surprise you that I would say that. Rabbi Harold Kushner, in his book quite a few years ago, Who Knows God, talked about how puzzled he was at his reaction when he went to see one of Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry movies. Now, I know some of you have seen those movies, right? You know, Make My Day. And Rabbi Kushner, intellectually, is a very anti-violent sort of guy, a very peaceful guy. And all during the movie, he sat there intellectually analyzing it and said, this is cheap and exploitative. And, you know, I don't think this is really good or healthy for any of us. And he had all of these intellectual questions, you know, going on as he was analyzing this movie. But then he found that in his gut, when Harry got the bad guy, in his gut he was saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was cheering. He was thrilled. And he was thinking, what's going on here? And then he recognized that his emotional reaction, his emotional satisfaction of watching Harry go about his business was a realization that he had within him a hunger for justice. That those who had harmed the innocent, that those who had confronted their brothers and sisters with cruelty, that when they received justice, this was a wonderful thing. And he says, deep in the human heart, there is this hunger for justice. And we should applaud that. We should be glad that we have that hunger for justice. It's what Jesus spoke about when he said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake, or other translations put it, who hunger and thirst to see right prevail. There is something wrong with someone who cannot rejoice when they see justice prevail. So if you experienced emotional satisfaction when you heard that Osama bin Laden had been killed, if you experienced emotional satisfaction at the thought of his being in hell, or as one of the cartoons put it, they showed the devil and Osama bin Laden, and the devil said to him, welcome to the real ground zero. It's a hunger for justice. But let's look more deeply into this thing. The real question is not, is Osama bin Laden in hell? But a more broad question. Who else might be there? Who deserves to be there? Is it possible that we can just pick out a few select individuals and say, these are the ones that are wholly responsible for the suffering of the world? You know, we can pick out, we can name their names, Osama bin Laden, Adolf Hitler, think he'll qualify? But is that really the totality of the story of human history and of human evil and human suffering? That if we could just identify this handful of bad apples in the world and we just eliminated them, the world would just be a wonderful place? Think that would fix it? Do you think it would really make that much of a difference? I don't think so. Not when you really look more deeply into it. The Holocaust, 6 million Jews and others were slaughtered. Is Adolf Hitler solely responsible for that? What about those who followed his orders? What about those who approved? What about those who just looked the other way? What about those who supported Adolf Hitler? The crowds, the multitudes. How did Adolf Hitler even rise to power in Germany? Well, if you know your history, you know the economic mess that Germany was in. Its economy was devastated. It took a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread. And historians tell us that one of the reasons the economy was so devastated in Germany in those years prior to Hitler's rise was that the Treaty of Versailles, when World War I was over with, that the West, including the Americans, wanted to make Germany pay and put on these huge war reparations to make them to pay for all of the damage and the destruction that was done during World War I. And because of just the burden of this immense debt that was placed upon them, their economy was crushed. Well, what about all of those who wanted to make Germany pay after World War I? Did they deserve some credit for the rise of Hitler? Brothers and sisters, the point is we can't fix the world or solve the problem of human evil by just picking out a handful of people and say they're the ones that are responsible for the hell that there is in the world today. The blame goes much more broadly than that. And even thinking of Osama bin Laden and his second command, al-Zawahiri, the one who's not been caught yet, the one who was the real mastermind of 9/11. How did they become who they were? What warped and twisted them and all the other terrorists? We don't know completely, but we have some answers. We can look at their recruiting tools, about what arguments they use to influence young men to join them in these acts of terror. These are all available on the internet, not only for us, but for prospects. They point out the repressive governments in the Middle East, the corruption that is there, what goes on in the prisons in the Middle East, and specifically they talk about torture. We know that al-Zawahiri spent 3 years in prison in Egypt, in which he was tortured. We know that when they questioned those foreigners who came into Iraq to fight against the Americans that were there, they asked them, well, why in the world did you come to Iraq from other countries? They said, Abu Ghraib. Torture. Sure, Saddam Hussein Osama bin Laden is responsible for the horrible evil that he has done, and so is al-Zawahiri. What about repressive governments in their homelands? What about what went on in the prisons? What about those who tortured? What about those who approved it? Do they bear any responsibility for the evil of terrorism? Again, the point, brothers and sisters, we just can't pick out a few people and say, they're to blame. They're responsible. The gospel message is that all men have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. The wages of sin is death. When sin is finished, it brings death. And if you take the little bit of sin of all of us and put it together, we're all, to some degree, responsible. Some of you have read William Young's book, The Shack. And he tells a story, fictional story, of a young man, of a man named Mac, whose young daughter Missy was abducted and murdered in horrible fashion. And in the course of the story, Mac meets Jesus. And he meets God the Father, who is called Papa. And at one point, he is brought into this dark cave, and he meets there a beautiful creature, a woman, a heavenly creature. He describes it as looking upon beauty itself. And they have a conversation. And at last she tells him that he is there for judgment. And this worries him. Because he doesn't want to be judged. Who of us does? And the woman says to him, no, you are not here to be judged yourself. She said, you are here to judge. So who is it that I am supposed to judge? God and the human race. She said it as if it was of no particular consequence. It simply rolled off her tongue as if this were a daily occurrence. Mac was dumbfounded. You've got to be kidding, he exclaimed. Why not? Surely there are many people in your world you think deserve judgment. There must be at least a few who are to blame for so much of the pain and suffering. What about the greedy who feed off the poor of the world? What about the ones who sacrifice their young children to war? What about the men who beat their wives, Mackenzie? What about the fathers who beat their sons for no reason but to assuage their own suffering? Don't they deserve judgment, Mackenzie? Mac could sense the depths of his unresolved anger rising like a flood of fury. He sank back into the chair, trying to maintain his balance against an onslaught of images, but he could feel his control ebbing away. His stomach knotted as he clenched his fists, his breathing coming short and quick. And what about the man who preys on innocent little girls? What about him, Mackenzie? Is that man guilty? Should he be judged? Yes, screamed Mac, damn him to hell. Is he to blame for your loss? Yes. And what about his father? The man who twisted his son into a terror, what about him? Yes, him too. How far do we go back, Mackenzie? This legacy of brokenness goes all the way back to Adam. What about him? But why stop there? What about God? God started this whole thing. Is God to blame? Mac was reeling. He didn't feel like a judge at all, but rather the one on trial. The woman was unrelenting. Isn't this where you are stuck, Mackenzie? Isn't this what fuels the great sadness that God cannot be trusted? Surely a father like you can judge the Father. Again, his anger rose like a towering flame. He wanted to lash out, but she was right, and there was no point in denying it. She continued, "Isn't that your just complaint, Mackenzie, that God has failed you, that He failed Missy? That before the creation, God knew that one day your Missy would be brutalized, and still He created, and then He allowed that twisted soul to snatch her from your loving arms when He had the power to stop him? Isn't God to blame, Mackenzie?" And Mac was looking at the floor, a flurry of images pulling his emotions in every direction. And finally he said it, louder than he intended, and pointed his finger right at her. "Yes, God is to blame." The accusation hung in the room as the gavel fell in his heart. "Then," she said with finality, "if you are able to judge God so easily, then you can certainly judge the world." Again, she spoke without emotion. "You must choose two of your children to spend eternity in God's new heaven and new earth, but only two." "What?" he erupted, turning to her in disbelief. "And you must choose three of your children to spend eternity in hell." Mac couldn't believe what he was hearing and started to panic. "Mackenzie," her voice now came as calm and wonderful as first he heard it, "I'm only asking you to do something that you believe God does. He knows every person ever conceived, and He knows them so much deeper and clearer than you will ever know your own children. He loves each one according to His knowledge of the being of that son or daughter. You believe He will condemn most to an eternity of torment away from His presence and apart from His love. Is that not true?" "I suppose I do. I've just never thought about it like this." He was stumbling over his words in shock. "I just assumed that God somehow could do that. Talking about hell was always sort of an abstract conversation, not about anyone that I truly..." Mac hesitated, realizing that what he was about to say would sound ugly. "Not about anyone that I truly cared about." "So you suppose then that God does this easily, but you cannot? Come now, Mackenzie. Which three of your five children will you sentence to hell?" "Katie is struggling with you the most right now. She treats you badly and has said hurtful things to you. Perhaps she is the first and most logical choice. What about her? You are the judge, Mackenzie, and you must choose." I don't want to be the judge, he said, standing up. Mac's mind was racing. This couldn't be real. How could God ask him to choose among his own children? There was no way he could sentence Katie or any of his other children to an eternity in hell just because she had sinned against him. Even if Katie or Joss or John or Tyler committed some heinous crime, he still wouldn't do it. He couldn't. For him, it wasn't about their performance. It was about his love for them. I can't do this, he said softly. You must, she replied. I can't do this, he said louder and more vehemently. You must, she said again, her voice softer. I will not do this, Mac yelled, his blood boiling hot inside him. You must, she whispered. I can't, I won't, he screamed. And now the words and emotions came tumbling out. The woman just stood watching and waiting, and finally he looked at her, pleading with her eyes. Could I go instead? If you need someone to torture for eternity, I'll go in their place. Would that work? Could I do that? He fell at her feet, crying and begging now. Please let me go for my children. Please, I would be happy to. Please, I am begging you. Please, please. Mackenzie, she whispered. And her words came like a splash of cool water on a brutally hot day. Her hands gently touched his cheeks as she lifted him to his feet, and looking at her through blurring eyes, he could see that her smile was radiant. Now you sound like Jesus. You have judged well, Mackenzie. I am so proud of you. But I haven't judged anything, Mac offered in confusion. Oh, but you have. You have judged them worthy of love. Even if it costs you everything. That is how Jesus loves. And now you know Papa's heart, she added, who loves all his children perfectly. Is Osama bin Laden in hell? I'm just a man. I don't know, but if I had to give my opinion, I'd say, darn right. And God weeps over that. And if you ask me, do I deserve to be in hell? I would say, darn right. I am responsible for so much suffering in this world through my actions and inactions and through my attitudes. On the day of judgment, I will stand there and say, here I am, just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. Jesus died for me, and he died for you too. if you would like to accept his love, if you'd like to confess him as personal Savior and Lord, we invite you to come forward and make your desire known as we stand together and join in singing hymn number 357, verses 1, 3, and 6 of Just As I Am.